Are you listening?
聞いていますか?
Ascolti?
듣고 계십니까?
Stai ascoltando?
Вы слушаете?
你在听吗?
Atem makshivim?
Estás escuchando?
Hören Sie zu?
Dari gushmidi?
Dame samrocho?
Hel tesma?
The Global Voices Podcast.
The world is talking.
Are you listening?
Hello, world, and welcome to another edition of the Global Voices podcast. I'm your audio friend, Jamila. In this edition, we're talking about literature and publishing. You'll hear some good old-fashioned interviews with well-read members of the Global Voices team, as well as readings of original work by our authors and the wider community. So if you're sitting comfortably, I'll begin. Our first reading comes from Greece.Veroniki Krikoni is a Greek translator for Global Voices Online. Her story summons up visions of the sea and the heavens.
Η συμφωνία των αστεριών, The Agreement of the Stars. Τα αστέρια περνάνε μια ζωή στο ταξιδιάρικο μπλε του ουρανού. Stars spend their whole life crossing the heavenly blue, carelessly watching down on the rest of the world. When their time has come to lose their light,They go to bed with their sweetheart in the depths of the ocean. They met her on a clear sky night, when she was bathing in the moonlight with her aquatic girlfriends. She dwelled in the depths amidst corals, rays, and shipwrecks. Even the moon himself was dazzled by her beauty. So he made them a favor. Every night he cast his light upon the sea waters that bring them home.So that the beauties don't get lost. A whisper came to her by the waves foaming on the rocks, by the seagulls which stole the secret from sailors who were studying the stars every night, trying to perceive their stellar madness, by the rain that brought the scent of damp clouds assisting to the scheme. Soon enough, the whole case surfaced and conflicts arose,Since the stars were over 1,000, but their sweetheart of the sea depths was only one. And after they made a gruesome quarrel, so angry that they were ready to burst into 1,000,000 pieces, they decided not to sadden her anymore, since none could have her alone. That was the agreement of the stars. They would start to dance every night to please their love. They danced in circles and in curious formations,which she gradually learned one by one as she crawled till the island shores. The bluff, the hunter, the cross, the seven brothers. One night, a star decided to sacrifice his cloud-walking loneliness. He left the dance and passionately crossed every corner of the sky before sparklingly falling into the sea.Where his beloved one waited for him to sleep together. Since then, the stars decided that they couldn't possibly agree who would win the heart of their beloved one. So, their time comes, and they silently make their last step in the celestial dance, and they set off their luminous last trip to the heavenly dome. They want to live for a last minute and unite with the rest of the world. That's why,They want to listen to everything. Some of them depart in crowds, unaligned, but each one of them hears something unique and acts differently. A last quarrel, perhaps, a dissonance. My soul, think twice upon what wish you spell every time you see a falling star.
Μέτρα καλά ψυχή μου, τι ευχή αναφωνείς κάθε που ένα αστέρι πέφτει.
Our next reading comes from Nwatrukwu Egbenike in Nigeria. He told me that he likes to write poetry because it's a format where a lot can be said in a few words. The inspiration for his poem is a friend of his who sends manuscripts for him to read. Early on in their friendship, the author was afraid that he might take his work and publish it. The writer pointed out that their friendship is based on trust. Nwatrukwu says, I don't know if you've seen the poem. I posted it on my blog.And we are good friends now. So here he is reciting his poem, Can I Trust You?
Can I trust you? Trust, he said, is a burden. Trust, I know, is a blessing. Trust without trust is the worst of all mistrust. Can we live without trust in these days of 19? Can I give and keep my trust, knowing that I betray my call? It's all in the opung. What if I disown my promise? Freedom from doubt makes the world open. Can I trust you? Can I make bond? Give my word, keep my pact? To doubt is human. To trust is higher. To remain in doubt is natural. To break a trust is infernal. Can a man keep his words? Can one take back what he has given? Is it super to promise? What makes one keep a promise? This, keep no bargain, irrational in essence. To break a trust is to turn into a beast. On and on can go on. Yet, the more I reckon, more am I sure-footed. Man can freely keep or break his word. Why? 'Cause he's free. Yet more free when he keeps his pact. 'Cause then he reflects beauty, being, one, and truth.
The publishing industry has seen seismic change as digital methods disrupt the traditional market. But digital publishing also creates opportunities and new ways of presenting the written word. Bernardo Parella is a translator, writer, and also the editor of Global Voices in Italian. He is now working on ways to publish Global Voices online material in a different way to make the most of the content. Here he explains how that works.
The idea started when I think about all the very heavy movement that we create on Global Voices itself. Each of us, or so many authors and so on, translators, we produce every day a great amount of content, articles, good stuff in any sense. I mean, by covering the breaking news from the Arab Spring to disappearing languages to a bunch of topics. So the idea was how can we reuse and make a greater value from all this great content that we produce every day. And then it seemed quite natural to organize them in a kind of publication or ebooks or you know, whatever we want to call them, but just trying to find a different format so they can have a larger target, they can be given away, proposed to other media partners and media outlet, and having a broader distribution. Given that, especially now with the easier way to produce ebook, to reorganize online and digital content in a format that it can be accessible and easy to read, to reuse, to enjoy from anybody in the world. The first titles should be about the European crisis, economic and otherwise. We have so many posts and articles about that. So to cover some kind of topics that are very interesting beyond Global Voices itself. So again, they can be appealing, interesting for other websites to take and to use. So, and then with also the idea about, you know, using the many e-store that are around from Amazon to even the Apple store or anything, just to find ways to, you know, different channels and, of course, non-profit website and organization in order to spread the word and to make Global Voices itself much more known for its, editorial and nice content production.
There's a wealth of material on the Global Voices online site. Is it difficult to edit this down to fit a suitable book format?
Yes, of course, it's a lot of work, as everything else on Global Voices. Because especially the process, it's not just a technical, of course, it's that we need to find first the titles that all of us we can agree upon. And then involving different editors, probably one at least for each group or for translators or for some regional editors. First, to choose the best or the most interesting or the most up-to-date post articles that can fit on that specific title. And then, of course, there is the assembling part, which is a more technical thing that cannot be that difficult at the last part, but mostly it's a very community effort. It's, as usual, with Global Voices, it's teamwork. And then we should find the right people also that have time and some knowledge in finding the right articles first and then working on a little bit on the technical part.
How did the process go to get funding for this?
Since I had this idea even a while ago and I was chatting about that with some people in Global Voices, and then when A few months ago, there was that grant award for expanding Global Voices to finding way to reach more people outside our community and also involving the people inside the community in some project that could be interesting in both ways, internally and externally. So the grant came up, so I decided to apply, and then in that terms, that's why the initial funding came after that application. So then my project got chosen, and so officially there are $5,000 for that. The idea is, again, to find also some people that technically can help us, so we can use that money for them. And then there is also another project I'm involved with. It's only about Italian ebooks, and then there's such a small, we can call it an electronic publisher in Italy. They are doing already this for several situations, so we can use their services. We can use, again, their little funding for some editors, the people that want to get more involved. So now we are in the phase of starting a specific space on the Global Voices website, blog style, where we can start working on what kind of titles are we going to have, what people are going to get involved in, which phase of the project, and so the project can go on. So,
is it the same approach to try and produce these as ebooks as it would be to make them into paper books?
It should be much easier, actually, but that's the idea. Yes, it's that branch of Global Voice could become, you know, an electronic publisher. And also, the project also involved organizing them not just as a simple PDF, which is the basic for ebooks, but also having them in different formats so they can be read on, you know, the small smartphone, tablets, and even maybe break down in small text, so it can be also read by someone who doesn't have a smartphone, like in many places in, you know, Africa or so, where they use a lot of text messaging, stuff like that. So we're exploring different formats also technically, but in the same fashion of, a new kind of publisher, that's the plan.
Will the books be released at particular intervals, or is it more when the news gets to a point that it is a good idea to summarize what's been happening on the site?
For now, we have a plan to have at least 4 titles ready by the end of the year. So we are starting right now. Then we have at the summit, I hope to have at least 1 or 2 titles, I mean, ready at least in a PDF format. So for now, we're just, again, having we are going a slow start. So we're going to have a few titles, 4 titles by the end of the year. But also the importance of the project is that every title will have its own space on the website, inside Global Voices website. So it's not just a page. The idea is to have a space where it can become another place for conversation, for posting other insights and commenting and other material. So each title becomes itself a project where everybody can get involved. Again, both from especially from the inside our community, but also having material and people getting on the website from anywhere in the world so they can contribute to create a better understanding about that topic. Again, that's what we're talking about, the European crisis. That's a classic because it's a very hot topic. We have a bunch of material. So as soon as we start to open up that page on the website with a PDF that we already are working on, then that becomes, you know, a hub essentially for more news, updating things, and so on. So it can go in parallel ways with the Global Voices coverage already, and then it becomes a more in-depth coverage, and then in itself, you know, it creates more content, it attracts more people. So it's a kind of a loop that goes on and on in that sense.
Exciting news there for Global Voices in a new globally accessible format. Check out globalvoicesonline.org and find out when that's going to become available.
Do you know about Global Voices Advocacy? With Global Voices Advocacy, we seek to build a global anti-censorship network of bloggers and online activists throughout the developing world dedicated to protecting freedom of expression and free access to information online. Find out more at globalvoicesonline.org.
So far, we've heard a story in Greek and English, and a poem read in English too. Languages and translation are key elements of Global Voices, and supporting underrepresented languages is particularly important. Eddie Avila is the Rising Voices Director of Global Voices Online. He works tirelessly to highlight languages that we might not otherwise hear. For the podcast, he worked with and read the translations of two people who write in a threatened language. The first is Elias, a language activist. His poem reflects his desire to hear younger Aymara embrace their language. He's encouraging them to speak in Spanish and learn to write in Aymara.
My dear Aymara speaking brothers and sisters, yes, I'm speaking to you. To him and her, to them. We should all realize what is happening. Today, everything has changed. Some call it the process of change, and others refer to it by the name of decolonization. Still others here and there say that it is living well. However, it appears that we haven't noticed exactly where we are going. Those of us who live on this land continue to speak in Spanish, as if we never had our own mother tongue. It is as if all our progress appears to come to a standstill. Let's rise up together with our mother tongue and begin to produce.
The second reading here by Eddie was made with Irma Alvarez Cosco from Jaquira in Peru. She now lives in Lima and says the poem was inspired by the Baguazo in Bagua, Peru. This was a time of persecution for the indigenous Mapuches, and the feeling of helplessness is a context for the poem. Irma says, "These words were my way of helping to find calm, as if all those people could speak in Quechua, or simply to find calm myself."
Lock up my body if you wish. Injure my heart. And if that makes you happy, pull my hair, tie up my hands and feet. Maybe you won't stop until you see my decaying body. It will be that way. Only the worms will escort me into the pits of my mother earth. Even though you don't believe me, I will also walk there. I will feed the trees with my decaying skin. Yes, I will give fruit to any plant so that my brothers and sisters may eat. And you will see how my brothers and sisters will become strengthened even more with my rebirth. And that's how I will scream in my brother's voice.
Ari,
yes, I am Quechua.
Ari,
yes, I am Anshaninka. Yes, I am Aymara. I am Shibibo. I am Mapuche, Awajun, and Aguaruna. Do what you wish, whatever you wish, but you will never take away who I am.
Do you know about Global Voices Lingua? Project Lingua amplifies Global Voices stories in languages other than English with the help of volunteer translators. It opens the line of communication with non-English speaking bloggers and readers of Global Voices by translating content into other languages. Find out more at globalvoices.online/lingua.
Not only do we have great writers with Global Voices, we also have great editors. One of our newest is Kevin Rothrock, who is the editor of Runet Echo. This part of Global Voices looks at the Russian internet, so please welcome him as he describes that work and reveals more about his connection with academic publishing.
Runet Echo basically monitors the Russian internet. That's the simplest way of describing it. But there are a few kind of focuses that the project has, and in order that they're listed on the internet anyways. The first one is the role of the Russian internet in civil society and politics, and that's the one I focus most on. My background is in history and political science, and so the kind of political aspect of the Russian internet is the one that holds the most fascination for me. But we also focus on other issues, for instance, the changing media landscape and the importance of online platforms in the way that news is reported, also internet policy in Russia and its effect on bridging the digital divide and developing the freedom of speech, as well as information security and cyber warfare. We've done a number of pieces on denial of service attacks that are very common between the various factions of the Russian blogosphere. And then finally, we have a kind of general interest in the landscape of RuneNet online communities. And there are several of them, and they're often sort of at war.
You also have a fascination yourself in Russian literature. What type of literature and why?
What fascinates me is literature about Russia, specifically academic literature. And I actually co-host a podcast on the New Books Network, where we interview authors that have written recent books about Russian politics, Russian history, Russian society, and so on. I tend to take the politics books, and Sean Guillory, my co-host, who is a historian himself, he takes more of the historical books. My background, as I said earlier, is in politics and history. I was a politics student as an undergraduate, and then I was in the doctoral program in European history at UC Berkeley in California, where I'm from. I actually met my future wife there, and she is now a Soviet history professor at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, where we live now. And in the time between meeting her and her becoming a professor in Connecticut, I worked for a couple of years at a think tank in Washington, D.C., and got involved with public policy relating specifically to American foreign policy with Russia. And that kind of reawakened my interest in contemporary Russian politics. And so that helped me get interested in working with Marshall Poe, who runs the New Books Network. Now I'm having fun talking to scholars and journalists that write books about Russia and Russian politics and all things contemporary under the Russian sun.
Is there a lot more freedom these days, then, I guess, to write about the political outlook of what's happening in Russia today?
Well, the farther away you are, the easier it is, I suppose. The scholars that I've been talking to have been American and English, and so naturally they can get away with just about anything so long as someone's willing to spend some money to publish their book. But regarding the Russian internet, it's usually said of the Russian internet, the RubNet, that it's the sort of last bastion of free speech in Russia. And while there are many, many eyesores to that kind of story, it is generally true that you can say just about anything on the Russian internet, and 99 out of 100 times, nobody's going to threaten to put you in jail or fine you. And 999 out of 1,000 times, even a threat wouldn't come through. And so I think that the idea that the Russian internet is this place of free speech, that's an important one. And from one perspective, it is the reason that you have sort of this great diversity in the Russian internet among bloggers and tweeters and so on. And it's also, I think, part of what energizes the very frequent conflicts that you see. People will fashion themselves as sort of soldiers of freedom and openness. And then people that are, you know, more aligned with, say, the authorities in the Kremlin, they will treat the freedom of the internet as a national security threat, that there are extremists that are encouraging violence and so on. And so on one hand, yes, there are groups that are actually sort of frighteningly violent. There's some validity, I think, to the idea that openness on the internet is potentially dangerous at times. But this is naturally exploited and used for sort of attempts at censorship. Sometimes they're partially successful. There are instances of bloggers getting fined, being sentenced to community service and so on for literally just insulting a state official. But at the same time, there are groups that are really quite frightening and are basically using the internet as best they can to organize very kind of violent groups.
With the literature that you mentioned that's written outside of Russia, are people inside of the country able to access some of that information, those writings?
Well, the biggest barrier is the language barrier. A lot of these books are translated into Russian, of course, but I think they bring with them the stigma of a foreign perspective, and that naturally will make the kind of general public less interested in it. And the fact that only some of them are being translated is obviously a large barrier, but I think the language barrier is the biggest one. And it's an interesting point because the academic conversations that happen outside of Russia and the ones that happen inside, there's often a sort of disconnect. And while most of the Western scholars have deep contacts among Russian journalists and Russian academics, the way the conversation happens outside of Russia, it's often different. And I don't think it speaks necessarily to the interests or even the history of the Russian consumer of such things.
Are there books, maybe ones that you read at the beginning of your career looking into this topic, that might help people who are kind of interested but just have no idea where to start?
Well, I mentioned Marshall Poe earlier. He's the creator and he's the one that runs the New Books Network. And actually, he's a pretty famous figure in the Russian history world. He's written several books on the subject, but one he wrote about 6 years ago, The Russian Moment in World History. It's about 100 pages, I believe, and it covers, I think, 1,500 years of Russian and Soviet history. Basically, he's trying to answer the question that I think is at the heart of just about anything that an outsider writes about Russia, and probably the heart of anything a Russian writes about Russia as well, which is what makes Russia so peculiar. It's neither a Western nor an Asian or Eastern society or country. But then again, it is and it isn't. So it's basically at this nexus of various civilizations, and it's a strange, strange place. And why is that? And that's essentially what Marshall Poe's book is about. It's something that's so broad and so short that I think that might be the best book possible to begin with for anybody that is just even sort of vaguely interested in what it is that makes Russia interesting.
Of course, you podcast about this. What's it like trying to put that podcast together?
It's surprisingly easy. The basic pitch for the New Books Network is it's a volunteer-run community, like much of Global Voices is also. And when I'm interested in finding a book, I'll just go on Amazon to find the best-selling books about Russia in a scholarly genre, and I'll just reach out to these authors and say, hey, will you talk to me about your book? And they say yes, because it's sort of in everyone's interest, right? I get to talk to somebody that I know will be interesting, and they get to get a bit of publicity for their recent product. It's sort of a kind of marvel that it can all work so well, and it actually does. So the process is surprisingly fun. Naturally, once I've gotten an author to agree to speak, then I have to actually, if I haven't read the book already, I've got to sit down and come up with intelligent questions. And so that part can be a little bit, nail-biting, I suppose. But generally, it's a really kind of fluid and surprisingly simple process.
So where do we find this podcast if we'd like to tune in?
It can be found at newbooksinrussianstudies.com.
So let's hear another story. Danica Radovanovic lives in Europe and comes from an artistic, literary, and musical family. So it's no wonder that she also writes beautifully. She's a social media researcher, internet scholar, and editor-in-chief for the Australian Science magazine. The story she is about to read is an expression of herself at a particular time, and she says she was inspired by events happening inside and outside of herself. On seeking feedback on this work, Danica says she showed it to a number of women who found a piece of themselves in this story. So here she reads, "You should date a woman who writes."
The woman who writes short stories, novel book chapters, findings, dissertation, observations, thoughts, ideas, columns, and then publish them and let others read in one, two, or several languages is the woman who writes literature of linear and non-linear discourse. Under the kiwi tree at the old writing table from the communist era, on her laps, in the bed, in the plane, in the train, the woman who writes in the hot summer days usually sits barefoot with her right leg crossed over her left, focused on the screen, and her multiple tabs hopping from one to another, trying to catch and gather the meaning. The woman who writes smiles to the screen when she writes. She smiles at you when she writes to you. She smiles when she writes and addresses to her imaginary friends from this box or from her near surrounding. She's complex, simple and quirky, fragile and feisty, passionate and unique in a way. That woman who writes. The woman who writes is sending you a book by the other author for your birthday. Sometimes, when inspired, she sends you her own literature. She may write a story and a book chapter about you or them, which she usually does, mostly fondly. She may invite you for a cup of coffee or tea by sending you an invitation via express mail with two tea bags in it, blushing in front of the post officer who examines the envelope before accepting to deliver it. Yes, the woman who writes is actually an old-fashioned young lady in a way. Despite her appearances of the geekiness, multitasking persona that she only expresses while on screen. The woman who writes prefers short stories with a sudden or unpredictable happy end or the promise of continued suspense, as she knows there will be many of them, interconnected, serendipitously written stories. She used to write pretending to be the other male author, tricking the literature jury by thinking that a man stands behind her words in her story, but as she's growing, she realizes that the only way to stay away from her own written stories and the way to express herself is to write as everyone but I. I read, therefore it writes. The woman who writes wrote his unfinished story 5 days ago on a malfunctioning laptop keyboard while you were sleeping, dreaming, having lunch, fighting or making love to someone, dwelling on your past or presence, blocking your future with your fears, had a business meeting, or maybe just reading the book of the other. The woman who writes is preparing material for her next chapter. The truth of literature consists only in the physicality of the act of writing, said she.
As a woman who writes, I'd say there are some wise words in there. You can let us know what you think in the podcast page comments if you agree. In our final reading for this edition, we have Njeri Wangare, a Kenyan performance poet, writer, and arts blogger. She runs a blog called Kenyan Poet and has been writing poetry for many years, as well as performing. She very kindly read two poems from her collection entitled Minds and Minefields, My Spoken Words.
When change comes, when villages grow into towns, towns into cities, shops into malls, spaces into estates, when streets turn into avenues, avenues into highways, superhighways, subways and runways, then things change. Villages become old, frail women deserted by their offsprings, all gone to the cities with big lights who, unlike prodigal sons, only return in coffins. Homesteads empty like the stare of a 9-year-old, eyes stiffened by industrial glue liquid, face barren of emotion. City streets give birth to illegitimate children, street children who at the age of 6 hang around city corners begging for a shilling. At the age of 16 you beg them not to harm you as they rob from you in these big city streets and big mall corners, subways and highways. Estates and villas, suburbs and urban spaces, metropolitan cities and industrial areas become fathers who sow wild oats to slum ghettos, poverty-stricken valleys. In these valleys, girls quickly grow into women, siring children at the age of 16, maybe even 13, where single families spring quicker than a spring chicken, where lands mushroom into shanties and ghettos with no jobs in mines, mine or offices. When kids can't go to school, only to sit in the sun, counting cars, watching others leave their dreams while theirs have been packed away like the textbooks in their bags, then innocence changes. When husbands neglect wives for brewing dents, choosing illicit drinks over tuition fees, when kids go hungry for days and nights, mothers are jobless, fathers are drunkards, when all one can show for years of sacrifice in school is a piece of paper, a college degree, while unqualified minds run governments and offices, then minds change. When opportunity looks at the color of your skin, asking for your names, who you know with lots of muscles, politically, spiritually, economically, when your surname, skin tone determines which doors remain shut, how fast handbags are clutched, who calls you up for a job, what neighborhoods you can take a stroll in, then thoughts change.
Well, that's all we have time for in this edition of the podcast. Thank you to everyone who took part with their reading, writing, translation, and interviews. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch up with you in the next edition. The Global Voices podcast. The world is talking. I hope you've been listening.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter. @ Global Voices. You can follow Global Voices stories on Facebook too.